Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Alex Golub. I'm a professor of anthropology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and I'll be the host of the channel for today. So I'm excited. Today, we're going to be talking to Elise Berman, the author of Talking Like Children, Language and the Production of Age in the Marshall Islands. This is a book that's a linguistic anthropological ethnography of life in the Republic of the Marshall Islands, or the RMI, as it's sometimes called. So if you hear us say that, it stands for Republic of the Marshall Islands. And it examines how age is created in and through interaction. So with that said, maybe we can just dive on in. Elise, not everyone grows up wanting to write a book on how age is achieved in the Marshall Islands. Can you tell me a little bit about your biography and how you came to write this book? How did you get interested in this place and this topic?
Absolutely. So I first became interested in the Marshall Islands just because there was a program at my college when I was an undergraduate sending people to teach in the Marshall Islands when we graduated. So it was random in some sense. I had not planned, nor had I heard of the Marshall Islands before that, but that was the program that was available to me at Dartmouth. And so I went there and learned Marshallese and fell in love with it and got very intrigued by language and by how kids were using language and how to understand the way the kids were speaking to me. So then when I went to grad school, I decided to study how sort of kids use language, how they learn to use it, the difference between truth and lies. And I did not go out to study age. I went out to study kids. And then the idea sort of transformed. But so then I just ended up going back and back to the Marshall Islands and studying language and kids.
And you went back to the same place where you had been. You'd been doing volunteer work?
Or yes.
You'd been teaching?
Yes. So I taught English and math. But no, I did not. So as a volunteer teacher, I was on Kili Island, which is where the Bikinian refugees were moved to. So Bikinian refugees are, when the U.S. tested their massive nuclear bombs in the Marshall Islands, they tested them on the two atolls, Bikini and Aniwetok, and Bikini is where one of the atolls that the Marshallese were moved off of, and they were moved on to Kili Island. So that's where I taught. When I went back to do research, I did not do the research on Kili, partly because transportation has gotten harder, actually, in the Marshall Islands over the years, not easier, surprisingly. And so there used to be plane flights once a week to many of the outer atolls, and there aren't anymore. But I went to an outer atoll, but one that was closer to the capital and that I could get to easier by boat.
Mm. And how did you get interested in kids? Were there kids just around, or what was it that kind of sparked your interest in that respect?
So I was always interested in kids, even before I went to the Marshall Islands. I was an anthropology major, an undergraduate, and I became interested in sort of how culture is learned and socialized. And it seemed like you had to study kids to do that. And frankly, I just enjoy spending time with kids. And it's good as an anthropologist to enjoy spending time with the people who you are going to be spending a lot of time with. So the decision to work with kids was kind of separate from the decision to work in the Marshall Islands, although they ended up going along together.
Yeah, it's funny. I definitely know that doing my field work in rural Papua New Guinea, I had never really thought about spending much time with kids, maybe just because I'm a guy. And I just loved being around kids. I love spending time with children. In America, you know, we have a very age segregated community. You just never get a chance to play with little kids. They're not just around the way that they are in a lot of other places.
Absolutely. And it's a lot of fun to play with the kids out there. And also, given that there is this big tradition in the Marshall Islands of these American teachers, for better or for worse, that's another topic to discuss, of going into these outer atolls and teaching English. A lot of villages are used to having sort of an American teacher roughly my age there every year. And the traditional pattern of those American teachers is that they spend a lot of time playing with kids. And so it happened that when I went back to do my research, I was sort of in a role that was very familiar to people, even though I wasn't teaching.
So they kind of had a slot for you in their mind of what that was. So why are there so many American teachers? I think Peter Rudiak Gold is also an ethnographer who does work in the Marshalls. And I know he got started as a teacher as well. Why are there so many teachers going to the Marshalls?
Yeah, actually, Peter and I were there at the same time doing research, not the same time teaching. But colonialism is the short answer. and it's the real answer. It was and effectively still is an American colony, right? And there are all these sort of neo-colonial ties. There's English is one of the main languages of education there. And so they get American teachers to go teach English. And that is because of the colonial American administration, right, that imposed English as the language of education for many reasons. And then the ties, the back and forth ties, both Marshallese coming here to the U.S., which is very, very, which is happening quite a lot, as I'm sure you know, in Hawaii, is also because of these colonial ties.
So this really is an area where the U.S. has had a long presence, and you're entangled in that colonial history when you do that work. And that's true for all of this region, which we would call Micronesia, for better or for worse. It's an Austronesian cultural area, part of the broader cultural area, but it includes places like the Federated States of Micronesia, Guam, the Northern Marianas Islands. These are sort of all part of this Micronesian culture area.
Absolutely. And that's how I ended up there in the first place, the teaching program. I went to Dartmouth, and the program that they had to teach in the Marshall Islands was started, I believe, by someone from Kwajalein, which is the Kwajalein is the American army base that's in the Marshall Islands that the U.S. essentially rents from the Marshall Islands in what's called the Compact of Free Association. But there's a lot of Americans living on Kwajalein. And so you have Americans who live on Kwajalein and then come back to the U.S. and then start these teaching programs, and these links get tighter.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to hear a little bit about your positioning. Maybe we should dive into the book and talk a little bit about that. You're interested in making an argument in this book about a fact, which is that age is negotiated in interaction in the Marshalls, or age is achieved interactionally or something like that. And it also seemed to me like you wanted to make a point that your analysis of that fact, or your claim about that, was going to advance anthropology or some other existing literatures, which I guess is not surprising because that's what we do when we write books and are on the tenure track. Could you maybe tell me a little bit about what your central argument is in the book and sort of how you think it speaks to some of the broader debates out there and proves existing literature?
Absolutely. So you summarized it well. My argument is that age is not natural, but cultural. It's sort of a classic anthropological argument and something produced through language and interaction. And I do get a lot of blank stares when I say this for some reason. I think it's helpful. I guess people haven't thought about age in that way that much. And so I think it's helpful to compare my thinking about age to trends of thinking about gender. Gender as something that is performed, something that's produced that varies across cultures. And so people perform age and ages produced in a variety of ways. And I talk about a bunch of them in the book. So ideologies of age are produced. Do we view it as chronological or as relative? Chronological ideologies of age are very prominent in the US, like in school systems. But relative ideologies of age are very, very important in the Marshall Islands, who is older or younger than whom. And that is both an ideology that's important, but also your status is then negotiated in age, because much of whether you're older or younger in whom than another is produced through how you speak. Older people command, younger people obey. The more you command, the older you become. The more you obey, the younger you become. And essentially, these are negotiations that take place in practice.
Yeah, you say, I think in more than one place in the book, age is power in the Marshall Islands.
Yes.
But I was a little, you say that, I think you said the more you command, the older you become. When some people say it's the other way around, the older you are, the more power you have. Can you maybe explain that a little bit?
Yes, I think they go together. So yes, in some way, age is constrained. And here you can think of it comparably to gender, right? So in some ways, yes, the older you are, the more you the older you are, you're going to command more. But people don't always take on those roles, right? And how do you know who is older than whom anyway, if you don't have chronology? People have lived with each other for a long time, but they generally don't know each other's chronological ages. Sometimes they don't even know their own. And you have people moving between islands a lot as well. And so these, especially with kids, when you have people coming into an atoll, and they haven't been there before. Some people might be bigger, so you might judge it based on sort of size, but size doesn't always go on with chronology. And I know of many instances with kids where I tried to figure out their chronological age. So I would track down their yellow cards, which is this thing that's issued by the Minister of Health when they're born and supposedly states their chronological age on it. And people would tell me things like, oh, that person's older than me. And I would look at the yellow card and it would be not true. And people would say that they were older because they feared that person, or that person commanded them, or they acted in that way. Now, it's certainly true that at a larger level, when the age differences are even more dramatic with like adults and children, it's clear that the adults are older and the youth are not, right? But even then, exactly how much power people have, how much older they are things that also get negotiated in interaction. But it's not completely malleable. It is constrained by how people see you, right? And how you have seen yourself over time. So again, comparable to gender, if someone has been perceived as a woman for a long time and sees themselves as a woman, it's not like they can just change it. But nonetheless, they are going to act in that, they are going to continue to perform in the ways that mark them as women, and they may try to change it. They may try to act in different ways, and there may be pushback against that, right? So, it's both produced and constrained, if that makes sense.
Like most things in life, there's some freedom of movement from culture, but then at the same time, their biological age, there are these developmental milestones that I guess are sort of biocultural and baked into us as a species.
So. Well, yeah, there are. There are debates as to exactly what those are and how those milestones are influenced by culture, right? So puberty is a big one. And that has a lot of environmental influences on it as to when it takes place, right? And there's biological debate about sort of how you like the age of different organs, right? And whether they all mature at the same time frame. There are questions. Teeth is the one that I've heard that is the most regular, actually. Humans tend to lose their baby teeth and get new teeth at a very regular sort of time frame, but other things can be quite malleable and more malleable than we think.
And I should just say for people who are listening, I think we might have gotten a little bit of piano practicing earlier.
Oh, yes, I apologize.
You have younger age people somewhere else in the house, so that's not us. That's not us mixing in piano music or anything into the podcast. That's actually all the contingencies of real life that we were talking about. Yeah. And You know, I guess a lot of people who think about the Pacific and aging, maybe they would think about Margaret Mead. You mentioned puberty. She famously made arguments about puberty. You're discussing the Marshall Islands as a place where there's a lot of hierarchy. You talk about age and being able to command people. And I think for some people, they might have this image of Pacific Islands as a place where, which are egalitarian, where people are sort of carefree or something like that. But and the another sort of preconception might be that people are on isolated islands or removed. But then you also just said that there's a lot of migrants. So can you tell me about how some of those popular perceptions match up to your own fieldwork?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, Margaret Mead worked in Samoa, and actually Samoa's hierarchy is has a perhaps more entrenched hierarchical system, at least with their chiefs, than does the Marshall Islands. But there are also a lot of similarities to Mead's research. Age, this seems to be true in a lot of the Pacific, but maybe not all of it. Age is a very, very important source of power in the Marshall Islands, and I did not go out there expecting to find that. But and I don't think that that necessarily contradicts with sort of egalitarian ideas, although the Marshall Islands is not an egalitarian society. There are chiefs and there are commoners, and that's the way it's supposed to be, people think. They don't think it should be egalitarian. But you owe respect to your elders, and elders command youth, and that's the way it should be, or at least that's the way people think it is. And that's the way sort of kinship systems function. And there is a great deal of respect for elders, and it's something quite lovely in many ways. I know, I think that a lot of readers and perhaps a lot of listeners have a very negative view of power, that elders shouldn't have power over youth. And that is not the way people think of it. It's very, very much embedded in respect. And the organization of kinship systems, the organization of food, the organization of children, care, because along with power comes care and generosity. So just as elders get to command youth, they have the greater responsibility to care for them. And all of these things go together. And I think that's actually quite similar to some things that Margaret Mead described in Samoa. She also, I mean, she described famously not necessarily age hierarchical systems, but sexuality, right? And freedom of sexuality. And that doesn't necessarily contradict ideas of age and power either. Those can go along with each other. What was the second? Oh, the second part of your question was about migrants, right?
Yeah, an inter-island movement.
Yeah. So people have always moved a lot. The Marshall Islands and much of Micronesia, they have always been seafaring peoples, and people have always moved between atolls and between what are now nations a great deal. So that is not new. There's now a great deal of migration to the U.S., massive amounts of migration to the U.S., largely because of the neocolonial relationship in this compact of free association that the U.S. has with their former colony, which is the Marshall Islands. And that is not one-sided migration. People go back. I know several people who have come back. And so there's sometimes circular migration, but it is a bigger out-migration than it was in the past. And that is due to a lot of reasons, increasingly climate change, but that's not the only one.
Yeah. So in Hawaii, you know, we also, like many other places in the Pacific, I think I have many students who see the positive sides of precedence, of hierarchy, the responsibilities that older and senior people have to nurture younger people, and they don't see it as necessarily a negative at all. As a matter of fact, you know, I think in the, I should say, it puts a lot of pressure on you as a teacher to perform, because you do owe a tremendous amount to your students. So, yeah. But your first chapter of your book tells this story in a slightly interesting way. In the Pacific, you know, adoption is very common. When you look at global studies of adoption, the Pacific is kind of the hotbed for it. People are, the term in Hawaiian is hanai, people are hanaid to different families all the time. And many people describe this as a positive thing where it's not about blood or primordialism. It's about nurture and spending time with other people. And there's something very nourishing and healthy about being able to have a wide community of people who you can get along with. But in your first chapter, you tell the story of a woman whose child was taken away from her by her senior relatives. And it kind of portrays a slightly more complicated and, dare I say, dark discussion of adoption and seniority. Can you tell me why you decided to tell that story and right up front in the beginning of the book? And I guess some people would say that it's not a, you know, as an anthropologist, you should paint a complimentary picture of your research subjects, you know, your hosts. And some people might not find that super complimentary. I don't know, how'd you deal with those issues?
Yeah, I mean, so I think, I do think that there's tension in adoption. I don't necessarily agree. So I don't agree that the woman's child was taken away from her. She was under pressure. And there is pressure imposed by elders to give sometimes. That is different from being forced, right? And there is tension in a lot of these systems about who gets kids. And those tensions are sort of embedded in the system where everyone is sharing kids. But I do think that, I guess I view the idea that her child was stolen from her as a more ethnocentric perspective than recognizing this very loving kinship system where people do share kids. And she didn't lose her kid, right? She shared her kid. And that did entail a loss on her part. It also entailed a gain on her part. And so I think my goal was to show the tensions, but to show how understanding the tensions requires viewing family in a different light, that there are different types of tensions embedded in these kinship systems and different types of power. So many people I've talked to about Marsha's child sharing practices are indeed shocked, because most of what at least people tell me that happens is not that people offer up their kids, but people ask for them, right? But that's because we operate with an assumption that birth parents are the sole owners of their children, people with the a priori rights to those children. And I do think that's an ethnocentric perspective that depends on sort of ideas of the nuclear family, right? Whereas we can see it that Pinla did not have automatic rights to her kids, right? Her child was everyone's, as it should be, because everyone was taking care of everyone else. And in that sense, what we see this is a very, very complicated negotiation. And they are complicated negotiations, right? And they have sadness and they have benefits. And there's power involved in negotiations, because there always is. The idea is to sort of change your mind away, both from the idea that a woman should have a priori rights to the kids, but also from the idea that it's not still a struggle. A lot of the pictures of adoptions of the Pacific have been like, oh, it's just easy. And that has not been my perspective when I've talked to people. It is a common part of life. It is an expected part of life. It is, I would dare say, a good part of life. There are tons of benefits to this adoption system that you mentioned, both for the kids and for the family members. For Pinla, who had a child very young, right, and who got a lot of help with that child. But it also can be a difficult one, right? And there can be sadness involved with it as well. And most women, I think maybe a good marriage, I don't know if it's the best example. Maybe sending a child off to college is the best example, where it's sad. It is sad. It's really sad for parents. But it's not bad just because it's sad. Or I thought of this example the other day, and I don't think it's exactly the best one. But when I think of my two kids and they have to share their toys, right? Sometimes they don't want to share their toys. It doesn't mean that it's bad for them to share their toys, or that it's not difficult to negotiate exactly how one's going to do that, right? That there aren't tensions involved in that. But it's still, and so it is a slightly different perspective on adoption, because I think that like the way that the birth mothers often feel is sometimes left out. But I would argue that it's only sort of taking the Western lens of the nuclear family and that the Pinla should have the right, sole right to decide what happens, that makes it seem sort of unsympathetic.
That's so interesting. I have so many thoughts about that. I love the sort of twinning. You're pairing on one side a sort of a sense of the ethnocentrism of our sort of Western slash American presuppositions with a strong sense of the ambivalence of family relationships. And I do, you know, if I can get on one of my own hobby horses here, I'm often struck how in a lot of contemporary discourse in the U.S. today, the family, or maybe it's just in Hawaii, I'm not sure, the family is seen as a place where there is no ambivalence, there is only love, there is only support. Mothers love all the time that they spend having their children and being, you know, nurturing their children. And it's capitalism and the public sphere that's sort of the source of all evil. So I feel like there is a kind of a rejection of ambivalence and an unwillingness to recognize the ambivalence and negativity in family life that happens in some of our discourse today, particularly in, oh, I don't know, maybe this is just, I'm imagining people on Twitter. I'm sure people are much more common than this. But on the other hand, you know, I don't know if you know that famous article, Is Multiculturalism Bad for Women? But I guess a lot of people would say, you know, it is my Western presupposition that women should have control over their children. It's also my Western presupposition that they should be able to wear whatever they want and not be put in a burqa by ISIS people. So it is ethnocentric, but that doesn't mean I should have any less moral courage or conviction. I suppose, you know, wanting to end racism against Black people is also ethnocentric, but you know, that's one I'm willing to stand up for.
Right.
So there are some complexities there in your example. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I should add with this particular example, I knew Pinla's family the best. And so it's their story that I told, right? And adoption stories have to be taken with a grain of salt. There are ways, the ways that people represent them. I know of plenty of instances when people were asked for kids and they did not give them away, right? Firstborn kids tend to be given away more than other kids, right? So there is a lot of different elements that go into this particular story that led to Pinla giving this child away. It was a beneficial arrangement for them in many ways. Right? Mm-hmm. This was a wealthier family. No one ever says that they wanted to give the child away. But given the fact that sometimes people do and sometimes people don't, right? There are obviously reasons. There are intricate reasons in each situation why sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. So it would be incorrect to say she was forced. It would be correct to say that there was pressure placed on her, right? If she had chosen to walk out of the house and go to her birth mother with that kid, she could have done that, right? So there's all sorts of sort of complicated things that go into all of, and we're never going to know exactly why a certain adoption, like negotiation, takes place the way it does.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. You know, just to make things even more complicated, I do know that, you know, because there is this history of people studying Marshallese, and there's also this discourse. If you go to Amazon and put in Micronesia, you will find, at least when I do, I don't know what your cookies are like, there's tons of self-published memoirs of working in the Marshall Islands, which portray the Marshalls as, you know, abject, backwards, having a culture that inhibits development, that they're responsible for their own problems. I'm sure you've seen some of this. And although I certainly do not think that you are producing that kind of story in this book. I think you're producing a really nuanced and very detailed account of the ambivalencies of family life, of power, love, support, and nurturance. you know, I do wonder over time whether you will get some pushback from people who will read some of this in through that lens.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. You know, there are also other authors who have written works on the Marshals, like Joe Genz, his ethnography, Breaking the Shell, or Holly Barker's Bravo for the Marshallese, both books that you all readers should read and teach to their students after they read and teach Elise's book. Those books sort of take a position where they're focused on a sort of an active alliance with Marshallese projects of cultural resurgence. Holly Barker is very active with political activism on the part of Marshallese refugees, and Joe is interested in resurgence of voyaging. So I think they're kind of positioned in this in a slightly different way in terms of wanting to make sure that they're actively trying to sort of promote those projects of Marshallese. And Peter Rudiak Gold's book is maybe captures a bit more of that ambivalence that you're talking about.
So, yeah, I mean, so my new stuff is a little bit different than my old stuff, but when I went out, there has been, I think Holly's and Joe Genz's books are wonderful and really, really important. There is a dearth of literature on kids in the Marshall Islands. Basically none. And I basically went out there wanting to capture and understand sort of Marshallese childhoods. So I did not have a specific sort of activist agenda when I went out there. And then maybe because of my training at Chicago, frankly.
I should just specify here. It's fine with me if you're not an activist. I don't think that's necessary. I think that is certainly a legitimate choice. And I really respect Joe and Holly's work. But I think you can still be a good person and write valuable work and not be an activist. So, everyone should feel free to pursue any kind of project they want as long as everyone consents to it.
But I think I also felt like there had been a lot of research on sort of the impacts of nuclear testing, which is wonderful because the impacts of nuclear testing have been horrible. And so we need that research. But somewhat less research on sort of some of these sort of basic issues about like how kids interact with others. Right. And so that is sort of what I went out to look at. And I'm now moving in a different direction. In the different direction that I'm moving, I think that my previous research has been sort of very helpful because I'm now looking at some education stuff in the US and understanding sort of these details of family life and adoption and all these things become really important to be being able to sort of pick apart some of these issues of education.
You know, one of my big topics living in the Pacific and being an anthropologist is trying to understand how it is that anthropology can contribute to knowing and studying the Pacific in the way that other disciplines can't. I feel like if ethnic studies and Pacific Island studies and anthropology and the School of Hawaiian Knowledge, if we're all teaching the same thing, then we're not all making unique contributions. I feel like there's got to be something that anthropology, and not just got to be, I think there is something that anthropology can contribute that other disciplines cannot, that makes it valuable in that interdisciplinary conversation. You know, instead of us being the master knowers of the exotic Pacific or something, we are one of many disciplines that can contribute. And one of the real things that I liked about your book was that you showed us how hierarchy, shame, consent, how these things work and how they work to make wonderful lives and how they function as sort of linguistic and interactional systems in a way that I think some people who work with Micronesians might not be able to understand. They might look at, you know, for instance, the silence of people who are junior in the relationship as a sign that Marshallese, you know, culture is an impediment to success because people don't want to pipe up. And I think you do a great job of explaining that this is not just some sort of backwards culture where people are mindlessly obedient or unwilling to become entrepreneurs or whatever it is that American capitalists think are wrong with Marshallese, but this is a complex way of life that works for people and has its own inner logic that you can understand, which I really appreciated that as someone who has to work with Micronesian people all the time.
Well, thank you. Thanks for that.
But in order to do this, you strapped cameras to kids' heads, is that right?
Yes.
There was some method?
Yes, I did. They loved it, actually. So I did a lot of work with kids and with adults, not just with kids. And I started out sort of I picked some focal kids sort of in the classic language socialization method, and I followed them around with video cameras. But it didn't work that well, partly because the kids move really fast. And it's hard to like get your tripod and your video camera and like get down the island with them, right? Because they go where they want, right? So I had this little people who like do sports sometimes wear cameras on their helmets, right? So something similar, but I put it on a headband, and the kids would put it on and sort of go around their lives, and then I would go find them half an hour later and take it off, and they loved wearing the cameras, actually.
So you like GoPro'd a bunch of 10-year-olds? Is
basically,
that kind of your method?
Yeah. So there's benefits and negatives to such a method. The audio isn't as good as you would get with a sort of tripod video camera and lapel microphones. The video can be a little choppy because the kids are running around. You get to see what the kids are looking at, which is both good because you see what they're paying attention to, and bad if they happen to something, other interaction happens to be happening that's interesting and you can't see it, but you can hear it because the video is not pointed in that direction. So, but it got a lot of really rich data, actually.
Most of the chapters in the books, for people who have not read it, they're just stories of kids playing or doing something, sometimes with you, sometimes without you. They're just little vignettes of maybe an hour or two of children's lives. And there's tons of quotations. It's like a sort of a dialogue. I'm sorry, I'm not very good at describing sort of style and rhetoric. But it's really just each chapter is the story of children trying to share a toy or buying soda or going to fetch their older sister or something like that.
Yes, I did that purposefully. I tried to make the book into a series of stories. Partly because of the way I was writing for it. I wanted undergraduates to enjoy it, and partly because I really feel like anthropologists, we have so many stories. But we often tell them so poorly. And that's really a loss because our data is just, all of our data is stories. And if we told them as stories, I feel like people would pay a little more attention. I purposely sort of, it was from a dissertation. I purposely rewrote the dissertation as a series of stories. And some of the stories come from like an hour, half an hour of videotaped interaction, and I would transform the interaction into dialogue. So it sort of reads like a novel, which I think is as legitimate a way of representing speech as a transcript.
I'm sure the vast majority of human beings who are not linguistic anthropologists would agree with you on that one. I mean, it has it doesn't have a lot of those highly edited transcripts that you see in linguistic anthropologists' work. It does seem like a story, but it really does have that very fine grained, like she said this, and the reason that she said this and not that was because if she said this, it meant that she was junior to that person, which meant that that person had to be the one to go talk to this other person. It really has that quality of the best linguistic anthropology where you're explaining the moves that are being made, the sort of dramatic micro moves, the sort of emotional and social moves that would elude someone who was not an expert in that culture. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was my goal, but
yeah, I thought it was pretty good. The chapter where you try to buy a can of soda, when no one is allowed to know that was great. Having lived in a place where, you know, it's very hard to own things because you have to share them constantly, in Papua New Guinea, that highly resonated with me. Can you maybe just tell people the story of what goes into trying to buy a soda on an atoll?
Well, so there's not very much soda on an atoll. and given that there's not very much, you are expected to share things just like you're expected to share your kids, right? And there's pressure to share, just like there's pressure to share your kids. And so if you want to buy a soda and somehow drink it without giving it to everyone, you have to hide it and not let anyone else see it. I did not know that. This story comes from a time very early in my field work, when a friend of mine asked me to go get a soda with her, and I said, sure. And I didn't realize all the difficulties that would go into that. And so we ended up talking to people, and she ended up sort of using me as a kid and making me talk for her. And so that I would be the one responsible for telling people, oh, we're going to go get soda, and then I would be forced to give it to them. So I ended up lying constantly because I found myself in these positions where I had to tell people, pretend I wasn't going to go get soda, pretend I was doing something else. And then we sort of rode out of town on our bikes and we had the soda, and then we couldn't get the soda back into town because if we carried it into town, we would have to give it to everyone. So then I found myself stuck in the woods with a couple of other women. And we were debating for what seemed to me a very long time what to do with the soda, whether to drink it there in the woods, which was my idea, and some of the other women's ideas, or whether to bring it back to our houses. You know, people don't necessarily say things directly. So we were all sort of talking, not talking over each other, but saying things indirectly. And finally, I just gave up because I'm an impatient American. I was like, I'll just take the sodas back. And I stuck them in a plastic bag on my bicycle and hoped that no one saw them, and got back to my house and thought that everything was great. And then lo and behold, a couple of months later, a friend of mine was talking to me and she was like, why didn't you give me soda? And I realized that I had just completely sort of messed up everything that one should do to appropriately sort of get out of giving in the Marshall Islands.
Yeah. There's in the United States, we have this sense that you should be honest and forthright and tell people what you think. But in the Marshalls, the way that you describe it, and I totally believe this, sharing is mandatory. If you have two of something and someone sees it, they're going to take one. And you cannot say no. So a lot of people, like I think you say at one point, people saw that you had soda. And so then if they had seen it, they could ask for it. But since they decided to let you have it, they would just act like they had not seen it.
So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So there was this sense in which people were choosing to have one kind of action happen and not have another kind not, so that their sort of lack of knowledge was produced in interaction, even though they knew that there was something that they've decided that they didn't know, so that you could keep stuff.
Yes. So, of course, at the time, I thought they didn't see the soda, right? Because no one said anything to me about it.
But that meant everyone saw it.
Right. So I assumed that no one saw it. And then I discovered later that they had seen it, but no one had bothered to say anything. And I think there are a couple of things going on there. We were on bikes, so we were moving pretty quickly. So it was hard to yell things after me. I was a bit of an outsider, an American, so people might have been more nervous about sort of demanding things from me at that moment. And I think the fact that they were in the plastic bags, actually, makes it a little bit different than if you're just sort of carrying them in your hands, walking past people. It makes not enough of a buffer, but at least a little bit, that it inhibits requests a little bit.
Yeah, you get the very subtle sense in which people are constantly negotiating what is the case. Because if some things are the case, then they can do some things. But if it's the other way, yeah, it's very subtle, and it's just very different, I think, to what a lot of people in the mainland U.S. are used to. It, Yeah, it kind of reminds me at some point as if like in some kind of like thriller or Hitchcock novel or something, like I know that you know, but yeah, it's interesting. And when you decided to do those chapters, it was because you wanted to make this book suitable for classroom use. I will say it's very thin. It's the body text runs to just about 154 pages, so it's you could easily teach it and fit it into a semester of teaching.
No, I was actively trying to make it suitable for classroom. Yes, I wanted people to read it. And I will say that probably affected. So the first chapter you were talking about, when you're writing something like this, you don't necessarily try to make it dramatic, but you're telling a story, right, in each chapter. And so you're using sort of various nonfiction narrative guidelines. And I read a bunch of nonfiction narrative books about how to use, how to develop a story, how to not tell the end of the story in the beginning, how to keep people interested, the narrative arc, and all sorts of things like that.
For our graduate students out there who are trying to do this or trying to turn their books into dissertations, do you have any reading recommendations, one or two books that you thought did a good job of helping?
Yes, it's called Narrative Storycraft by Jack Hart. Is okay. The main one that I used. That was my goal sort of in transforming the story, the books, the stuff from my dissertation to these chapters. And I think in doing that, I kind of run some of the risks that you talked about before with the first chapter, right? Like if I had hidden the ambivalences that I saw, right, about kinship, behind sort of anthropological jargon, it's harder to see them in some ways. Not that it's harder to see them, but they become a little less clear, right? And in some ways, I wonder if I should have done that. But also trying to tell a story. And so it's interesting. It's an interesting sort of negotiation to play.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely make your point up front. The book is, I mean, one of the things that I noticed, maybe I chalked it up to you coming from the more linguistic-y side of things, the book is just relentlessly structured. It's full of well-signpost sentences that say, in this book, I claim that. My purpose in this chapter is to, every paragraph starts out, I mean, this, I'm saying these things as a compliment, Elise.
You
know,
thank you.
Every paragraph starts off, you know, there are many ways in which Marshallese avoid giving. First, second, furthermore, in conclusion, and it's just sort of a clinic in terms of how to write sort of a structured prose. So there is a narrative side to it, but there's also a very sort of well-structured academic expository side to it. If anything, like when reading it, I kind of got the sense that it was your thesis, but radically dehydrated. So that all of the pages of discussion about one way of giving just kind of got sucked down into, first, food is often hidden inside containers. I got that feeling of dehydration when I was reading.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I tried to do. It is a first book, right? So things change, right? When one gets to one second book.
But. Yeah, I mean, you have to make decisions about what your book is for and why you're writing it and what you want to do in it. And then you need to be able to execute that. And then for other book projects, they might have different kinds of frames or goals, and then you can do something else as well. So, you know, first books, I don't know, because I do this podcast, I interview a lot of people and sometimes it's hard for people to keep their ambition in check in their first book. Their kind of whole life is in it because it's the only book they've written so far. I definitely would say that I was guilty of that in my first book. Whereas I think there's a strong craft component to the way your book is written, where I can see that you had a goal and you did it. It's not your philosophy of life in kind of, you know, crammed into the epilogue or anything like that. Yeah. You know, at the same time, we talk about it being well written. You use terms like language ideology and index and intexicality. You, like me, are a Chicago student, And you kind of have this linguistic anthropology semiotic approach. That approach is kind of famous, I think, for outsiders as being incredibly jargony and sort of saying things that lots of other people have already said in more normal ways. So one of your particular challenges was taking that Chicago semiotics, or maybe it's now a Mi-Chicago semiotics approach, and sort of bringing it down into English. Did you think about how you would do that and sort of your place in that tradition, how you would try to explain to people this very complex approach in sort of a more easy to read language?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I tried to minimize the jargon, but I still had some. I mean, I have to get tenure, right? Mm-hmm. So the book is serving several goals, right? And I think it helps. So I'm a Chicago grad, but I was at the Department of Comparative Human Development, not anthropology. And so I took a lot of the semiotic classes over in anthropology and in human development, but we have to talk to sort of sociologists and psychologists in human development too. And I think that it sort of trains a different way of talking about things like index and icon and things like that. So I tried to use minimal jargon, and I tried to define the jargon that I used, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. I didn't think I could get rid of it altogether, because I am trying to make some theoretical arguments in the book as well. And to do that, you need to talk about, and indices are very important to sort of the theoretical argument that I'm making about how age sort of is produced.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about this earlier. Your goal is to make an intervention in theory, which, as you said, is one of the things that you want to do for getting tenure, but also trying to make theory better and having better ways of understanding the world is to me a perfectly legitimate choice. So can you maybe, just as we close, talk about, you know, sort of whose work you're sort of trying to improve, or how this book is not just about the Marshallese, even though I'm as a Pacific person, I'm interested in that end. Where are you trying to take that theoretical conversation about age?
I want to make age more prominent, not only in anthropology, but I think we can think beyond anthropology too when we're getting into sort of politics and things as well. So anthropological theory is, I wouldn't say it's neglected age, but has under-theorized age compared to things like particularly gender and race, and to a certain extent class. And I think this has a number of implications. One, and we can think practically outside of anthropology, age is enormously naturalized in much of our social institutions in life. And although people have started to think beyond the academia about sort of issues of gender and race, this naturalization of age is rarely questioned. So the most obvious candidate for this is the school system, right? Which runs on an age segregated system according to chronological age, right? And most of us protest at the idea of gender or racially segregated classrooms, but we have chronologically age segregated classrooms, and we think this is natural and just. I'm not necessarily saying we should not have chronologically age segregated classrooms, although it's new. We didn't have it. It didn't exist in the 1800s, right? But it is a particular approach to age sort of embedded in our ideologies that affects the way we organize society without necessarily even thinking about it. And then when people talk about things, and I have two young kids, so I hear this from parents all the time, things about like developmental delay, like kids who are behind in school, all sorts of things. All of this is dependent on this idea of chronological age that just seems so natural to everyone. Then we can go beyond that, beyond social institutions, to thinking about like other things that anthropologists study: race, gender, subjectivities, power, agency. And I would argue that by neglecting the aged components of them, we're not really studying those phenomena. So agency is an obvious one, because that's what I talk about in the book a lot. But what I'm arguing is that agency is aged, but it hasn't necessarily been studied like that. People who take on different age positions in society have different forms of agency and can do different things. And to understand sort of how action and interaction in social life takes place, you have to look at sort of all of this together. And by taking age in this way and thinking about how gender changes across the life course, how subjectivities change across the life course, then sort of we already think about culture as dynamic, but it becomes really, really dynamic because it is very sort of complicated. Every sort of element of culture takes on myriad of different forms. And age is one of those things that people are constantly changing in their own age, right? Or at least we perceive it as such. And so they're constantly sort of moving through different sort of subjectivities, all of which are culturally formed. And I think it places all of these processes in a sort of different light. And that actually brings me to, oh my gosh, I'm sorry about that.
No worries.
Telephone. Turn that off.
It happens. Take
it off the hook. So if we think about Pacific anthropology, there are some things that have been prominently studied in Oceania, such as gift-giving, right? But few, if any, of those studies look at how gift-giving is aged. We agree it's gendered now. So Marilyn Strathern taught us that.
Yes, and Rena Letterman,
yes,
I will note. Yes,
yes, absolutely. But like in my research, children are invaluable economic agents because they are children. And as people who are different than adults, they can do different things. And it turns out those different things that they can do are really crucial, like carrying goods around the village. The adults can't do that. And so a lot of these giving practices that we have discussed, at least in the Marshall Islands, don't take place without the children as animators. And are dependent on all these people of different ages interacting. And so this suggests that like a lot of the classic anthropological things that we have studied in Oceania as well as elsewhere are incomplete if we don't take sort of age dynamics into account.
Yes, I have noticed that the number of sessions on aging in the Pacific at ASAO, the Pacific Anthropology Meetings, has increased as prominent members near retirement and suddenly become interested in aging. I suspect that, you know, you talk about how aging is understudied, and I agree. But it seems to me today, like maybe one of the things that your work dovetails into is the way in which age and power are now being discussed in social media and contemporary politics in a way they might not have been before. You know, the hashtag okay boomer, or the sort of the way in which millennials feel, correctly in my opinion, that they've been screwed by the Great Recession. You know, there's always been generational talk in America, but I feel like maybe now in popular culture people are thinking about cohorts. You know, generational cohorts and their power and their sort of structural place in a way they haven't before.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would say a lot of this is after I wrote the book. So I would, yeah, think about how that's happening. I should also say that there's a lot of work in anthropology and other things on both aging and on kids. I think we need to sort of move beyond looking at the life stages and take, and I build on some of my mentors like Jennifer Cole in this, and thinking about age itself as an analytic. So getting away in the parallel here again with gender is not studying women or men, but studying gender, right?
Right.
And I think that's a lot of anthropology, at least thus far, we've been studying kids. I'm involved in ACYG, the Anthropology of Childhood and Youth Interest Group, right? Or we've been studying adults, but the people who study elders and people who study kids don't really talk to each other because it's assumed that their topics are different, even though the general category is similar.
Yes. And so, you know, we're coming to the end of our time now. I don't want to keep you for any longer than we have to, but you mentioned some new projects. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're working on now?
So I'm working on Marshes migrants in the U.S., in the South Central U.S., and I'm looking at migrants in schools and sort of interpretations of the schools on their like language practices and ideas about the Marshes kids as well. And there's sort of a lot of misinterpretations, it seems to be, in the school system of many of the things that I talk about in the book, like Marshley's family practices, adoption, various things like that. And there also seems to be a fair amount of sort of misinterpretations of language, including some things that I hadn't thought about at all before, such as sort of the form of world English that has taken place in the Marshall Islands as a result of American colonialism, and consequently the type of English that Marshley's kids might be speaking in the U.S. and potentially in the Marshall Islands, in Hawaii, although I'm not as familiar with the Marshleys there. Marshleys are very disadvantaged in the school system here, so I'm starting to take a look at sort of how these things transfer.
Interesting. It sounds like a really great project, bringing together some of the work that you've done in the Marshalls on language and age and social structure, and then running that up against what happens when those people sort of encounter a culture which is different, but which they have a long history of connection with. Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed our talk. I thought it was great. And I really do think that your book is worth a look at as well for people who are interested in trying to teach something on the Pacific or learn a little bit more about Marshallese or Micronesians. So Elise Berman, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.